action, excitement,
romance,
thrills and chills,
swords and sorcery,
rockets and ray guns,
a dizzying panoply of the strange and impossible from the darkest depths of the human imagination. What mad universe encompasses such tales as these? Join us as we bear witness to the sweeping sprawl of all the history that never was and all the futures that could yet be. It's Adventure As You Like It on What Mad Universe.
Something seemed to tell Thubway Tham that this was no time for levity. He did not like the manner in which the eyes of the Crimson Clown glittered through the mask. He did not relish the muzzle of that automatic pointed in his direction. So Thubway Tham decided to behave himself and listen, and not rebuke the Crimson Clown for his intrusion.
"I've got a job for you," the clown said.
"What thought of a job?"
"Something in your own line," the Crimson Clown replied. "And I'll pay you well for it. $1,000. It is very simple, Tham. I want you to get a wallet that is being carried by a certain man."
"Yes? Why come to me?"
"Because you are about the cleverest pickpocket in town, and you also have a reputation for being square," the clown replied.
"I don't have a mix-up with anybody else's business," Tham informed him.
"You aren't mixing up in anything now. I'm merely hiring you to do the job." "One moment."
One of the Crimson Clown's hands disappeared into the front of his costume. It came out holding a little bill of rolls, which was tossed upon the bed beside Thubway Tham.
"Count it. 500. Cash. When you've done the work."
"So you are trusting me with this?" Tham asked.
"You have the reputation of being square. And if you did double-cross me..." The Crimson Clown did not conclude the sentence. There was really no necessity of him doing so.
Thubway Tham realized the unvoiced threat. Thubway Tham meets the Crimson Clown, 1928, by Johnston McCulley. Hello, and welcome to What Mad Universe. I'm Philip Reith, and with me as always is Adam Prother.
Hello, I am the Crimson Clown, apparently.
Yes, today we're talking about a book by Johnston McCulley, best known as the creator of Zorro. This has nothing to do with Zorro, though.
Well, except perhaps in spirit, but yes.
It's pretty far from Zorro, I'd say.
Yeah.
I haven't actually read any of the original Zorro things, though I've seen some Zorro media, obviously, but Zorro is definitely his most popular character. This is probably his second and third most popular characters crossing over, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, since no one's ever, let's be honest, no one's ever heard of them, second and third is a tie for last place in this case. But hey, good for him for being a popular writer at the time.
Some people say like the Black Bat. McCulley had a bunch of other characters. There's the Man in Purple, the Black Bat, the Green Ghost, the Spider, who seems like an interesting one. This is not this isn't the famous Spider. This is another... Right. This is like, I haven't read any of these, but there's apparently six of them. It's a master criminal who's in a wheelchair, and he does all his like planning from like his apartment, and like people come to him, and he plans out crimes and stuff. Seems interesting. I imagine it's based on that line from The Final Problem, where Moriarty is described as like a spider sitting on a web, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's exactly what I was going to say. It sounds like Moriarty, and I mean, we're kind of coming up around the same time. Now, this was in Europe, but I do know at this time, as we've discussed in, for instance, when we talked about Dr. Mabuse, that this was the popularity of the sort of villain protagonist in pulp. That was a common thing. And Fantomas and a couple of others we've mentioned. I guess kind of. Who's the hypnosis guy? Svengali.
Oh, no, he's not a protagonist. He's...
Oh, okay, fair. But there was definitely a whole threat. Like... He created, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle had Moriarty, who is, as many people like to point out, is basically in one story and dies. And although, I guess, sort of, his presence is sort of felt in one or two other stories. But, like, he's comparatively minor figure in Sherlock Holmes mythology, but he's been elevated. Like, clearly the idea caught fire with people, and I don't know if that was the inspiration for all these sort of Moriarty-type super crime villain bosses, but that became a real thing. But McCulley's characters, from what I see, are much more heroic. They're on the wrong side of the law, but they're good guys, and that seems to be... That was something I was going to mention, because every character you've mentioned, including Zorro, and that's why I said it was somewhat in spirit, is on the wrong side of the law, right? Am I wrong about that?
Yeah. All these seem to be, in some way... like, a lot of them are Robin Hood types. Like, the Crimson Clown steals from the unworthy rich, that's his sort of gimmick, and gives half the proceeds to charity.
Right, exactly.
And folds the other half into, like, future crimes.
Yeah, he definitely seems to be going with the Robin Hood idea of, like, being on the wrong side of the law doesn't make you immoral or unheroic. Like, that seems to be his thing.
And Tham is, he's a pickpocket, he steals for his own living, like, he doesn't... But he's sort of a good guy, like, in the stories. The Tham, and I this is going to probably trip us up, but it is Thubway Tham, because he has a lisp, and his name is actually spelled that way.
Yeah.
And all his dialogue is spelled out phonetically.
Yeah, and everyone calls him Tham, no one calls him Sam.
Yeah. He was created in 1918, and there were stories featuring him as late as the 1950s. So, and there's, like, over 100, I think 150-something stories featuring this character. So, obviously, McCulley liked writing this character.
Yeah. Well, it's a fun...
And, like, these are very short stories. Like, they're, like, 5 to 10 pages. Like,
yeah. Yeah, of the two characters, this is the one I've read a couple of the stories of. And, I wonder, this is literally just occurring to me, or I would have researched it a little, but I wonder if the stories of Damon Runyon had an impact as well. Do you know who Damon Runyon was?
No.
He was the guy, he wrote the stories that became the basis for the musical Guys and Dolls.
Okay.
And it was, he wrote a bunch of stories about, like, basically lowlifes on Broadway, which was apparently known for being kind of a shady part of town at the time, in the 20s and 30s when he was writing. And they're mobsters, and he goes, so most of you know I am keeping myself, my nose clean and keeping out of trouble, but I had some business to attend to in the East Lane. He's like, that's how he talks, basically, and that's the narrative voice of his stories. But he's, yeah, they're stories about lowlifes, and, like, they're all criminals, but they're all, like, kind of have a heart of gold. Some of them get a little more serious, but they tend to be comical stories. So I wonder if that was, like, an inspiration, or if it was just they were drinking from the same well, or...
Idea.
Yeah, but that's really... Like, Runyon is very well-known and well-acclaimed in sort of literature to this day. So, I mean, it's just really interesting to me that was such a popular thing in the early 20th century before World War II, that you could just have not even an anti-hero, really, because they are heroic. They have a code. I liked that Thubway Tham, like, he had, yeah, as you say, he is just a pickpocket, but he has a code. Like, what is it? He only works on the subway?
He has a frenemy in Detective Craddock, the guy who's always trying to catch him, but they have, like, a mutual respect. It's just, like, a rivalry respect thing. And they always meet up almost every day and exchange, you know, the same dialogue in each story that's, you know, I'll send you up the river, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they sort of insult each other, but, like, playfully.
Right.
When Tham says, I'm not going to ride the subway today, Craddock believes him, because Tham is a man of his word.
Mm-hmm.
If he's more cagey about it, Craddock will try to keep on him, and he usually lifts a leather under Craddock's nose or that sort of thing. But if Tham says... Yeah, I'm not riding the subway today. I'm not working today. Craddock will just, okay, I can do other things then. With a peace of mind. There's one story where Tham says he's not going to work on the 4th of July to Craddock. And then, but he keeps being faced with temptation with these two guys who are carrying their wallets in their outer coat pocket. And, you know, just sort of, and talking about how nobody could pick their pockets in front of Tham. And,
I sure hope the wallet inspector doesn't come along just now.
Yeah, exactly. And Tham sort of gives into temptation and picks their pockets, but then discovers and feels really guilty about it because he said he wouldn't do it. And he's a very superstitious guy, and he's afraid if, you know, he breaks his promises and stuff, then he'll get bad luck. But he looks and he finds out that it's, you know, like an hour after midnight, so it's he didn't rob anything on the 4th of July.
He lost track of time, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so that's the sort of, yeah, there's like comical endings, you know, that sort of
thing. That is funny. Yeah, one of the ones I read was he ends up getting a ticket to a policeman's ball. Like the policeman, because of course the police are trying to sell tickets as hard as they can, may raise the thing, and he thinks it'll be funny. And then another actual pickpocket is operating at the policeman's ball, and so he feels. But and of course, Thubway Tham is the one who gets targeted, and Craddock literally comes to his defense, is like, "No, Tham said he would not do that, and he's not going to do it." And of course, the other guy is like he's a bad pickpocket who just steals, yeah. And you know, so he gets busted basically. Yeah, like so. It's a I didn't know that. I didn't get that. About the superstition aspect, but I guess so. The idea is like he thinks his luck will run out if
yeah.
he gets.
It's both a moral thing, but also like it frequently says that he's very superstitious, and if he gets a hunch that something bad will go, you know, down that day, then he won't go into the subway, even if he needs some money. You know, like he's very, very superstitious.
Right. Which yeah, that's a nice little. Twerk. But yeah, like it is interesting that yeah, he's just purely the hero, and Craddock is almost like I wanted to say you like to mention Lupin the Third, and who's
oh, yeah,
another
very Zenigata. There's Crimson Clown also has a Zenigata, so
right
team up in this crossover. So we'll
and of course Lupin
later.
Is another one of these types of characters that we're talking about. The original Arsène Lupin.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, but it's not really a Zenigata relationship because Zenigata is always trying to catch him and just can't quite do it. And it's like
I mean, Craddock wants to catch him.
He seemed very paternal towards him in the stories I read. Like he was not.
He does seem to want to catch him, but at the same time, he likes this guy.
Yeah,
like they like each other, but they're like the sheepdog and the wolf and the, you know.
Yeah, right.
Like they're friends, but they sign into work, and you know they both have their job to do.
Yeah, fair enough. And I mean, I also got the impression because there's in the cop episodes, there's like a cop who's a jerk as well, and it's kind of like I got the impression he's like the cop who actually goes like, well, this guy's not really that big of a threat, you know, compared to all the things I could be arresting, you know, even though he does.
I mean. He is stealing a lot, because in these stories, he's the only person who works the subways. Mm-hmm. Everybody else stays, like, all the other dips, and that's the phrase. I don't know if that's the actual term.
Yeah, I've heard that. I have heard that before, yes.
Okay.
A dip.
Pickpocket, yeah. All the others stay out of the subway out of respect for Tham. Like, he's not threatening them. It's just, like, he's just the, you know, that's his territory. We'll leave it to him.
Yeah, exactly. Then the obvious thing to think of is you could just bribe a cop to not to leave you alone. That's another thing you could do. But of course, they're not going to do that. Well, I'm not going to say they could never do that in a 20s. You said he was from he first appeared in 1918, if I've got this right?
Yeah.
So yeah, he goes quite a ways back. And then, there's the Crimson Clown. So I didn't
know.
I
had a few more solo Tham stuff to
okay
convey.
go ahead
we mentioned his heart of gold thing, and like he's charitable to other people. There's one story where he finds some of his neighbors, and there's like an older man and his wife, and they're like living in a shabby house, and they're, you know, wearing shabby clothes and eating like not great meat and stuff. So Tham has come into some money through, you know, his job. And so he starts anonymously buying them fancy stuff, like fancy meats and coats and stuff. This couple just keep going and selling these things and trading them for like cheaper meat. And Tham keeps, you know, trying to give them, they'll warm up eventually to this nice stuff I'm buying them. And then at the end, it's discovered, or he finds out through Craddock, that these are not poor people, they're just misers. And in fact are quite rich and are like landlords around town.
Oh boy.
And so Tham follows him around as revenge, follows him around as he's taking collections for his, you know, rent collections, and then robs him at the end of the day, figuring that the loss of some money will actually, you know,
yeah,
upset him greatly.
Yeah, they'll actually have a reason to be misers now.
Yeah. And there's other one, like he one story about him wanting to serve a Thanksgiving meal to a bunch of like poor kids, and having to raise, you know, money for that, despite having Craddock on his trail and that sort of thing, and not being able to work properly.
Right.
I can't remember how that one, how he gets that through that, but he manages to do it. So yeah, he's a lovable crook.
Yeah, he always takes in a small boy or an idiot man child to under his wing. Yeah, exactly.
He's also not infallible. You know, he's like the best pickpocket in town and stuff, but he plays poker and he's really bad at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he keeps losing money at poker, and like that's a, and like he dresses shabbily. And there's one story where Nifty Noel, who's a repeated recurring character, is like a con man who dresses really flashily, makes fun of Tham for his fashion sense. So Tham goes out and gets like the best new clothes, and everybody's just sort of laughing at him because they're like really tacky. And he finds that this is actually, you know, not great for a pickpocket because everybody's looking at him when he goes onto the subway.
Right, right. Yeah, they could, yeah. He should team up with Nifty Noel. They should work together as the distraction. Does he ever have, like, someone he hires to be a distraction? Does that ever happen?
A bit. Like, there's one where everybody, like, the Craddock's on his tail, so he actually hires an understudy. To do so, he'll train this kid to how to be a pickpocket, and the kid keeps taking risks that Tham wouldn't, and
yeah,
it becomes like a morality tale about listening to Tham's advice.
Always listen to your elders when they're trying to teach you how to steal stuff. Yes,
he's late 30s, but yeah,
he's a year older. That counts anyway.
Yeah, so let's talk about Crimson Clown then.
Mm-hmm.
Crimson Clown is more of he's not a superhero, but he wears a costume. And this, I've talked to Ing about this character, and Ing is very disappointed that he's not an actual clown.
I mean, his costume dresses like a clown. Doesn't that make him a clown?
No, he doesn't. His costume is that it keeps being referred to as a clown costume. It's a red hoodie with a white face.
Hmm.
It's like a full body red onesie, and he's got like face mask that's just plain white with his eyes peeking through.
A face mask, okay. I mean, there's different kinds of clown. There's, Commedia dell'arte characters who wear masks. That could kind of count. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a bit of a stretch to call him a clown, even though everybody does. But
yeah.
And sometimes it's described as like, because it's a silk costume that he wears over his clothes. And sometimes it's described as puffy, so maybe it could look clown-like.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's a wealthy man about town named Dalton Prouse, or Prouse? How would you say it?
How do you spell it?
Prouse.
Prouse, yeah.
Okay, Prouse. That might not be his real name. It's a little from the stories I've read, and not all of them are available. There's two collections that are in print, and the rest aren't. Like, they haven't been republished since like the 20s or 30s. So there's about 19 stories in total, and I've read probably 8 plus the crossover. So
sorry, how many stories in total?
About 19.
Mm. Oh, okay. All right, so not
as many as Tham.
Right. Okay. When did the Crimson Clown premiere? Do you know what date?
26.
Okay. All right. So you can really see, like, just from the description that you've got there, even putting aside the fact that he's only a hero in quotes, he you can see the influence on superheroes that was kind of building at this point. This is years before the technical existence of a superhero, but definitely part of the ingredients that were starting to fall into place for superheroes were becoming popular at that time.
I mean, definitely stuff like Green Hornet and stuff is feels like it's inspired in some ways by the Crimson Clown. Particularly, Green Hornet has the gun that shoots out sleeping gas.
Right.
Or knockout gas. Crimson Clown has that in the later stories, apparently. Early on, he uses a syringe that he plunges into people to make them sleep. And he also has a gun that shoots out tear gas.
Mm.
So I guess they were combined over time into one weapon, but I haven't gotten to those yet. Because, I've read what's available, but... and that seemed to be actually a common thing with Macaulay's characters, because apparently the Black Bat does that, and the Black Star does that.
Okay. It has a gas gun, you mean?
Yeah, gun and gas bombs, you know, just... Mm-hmm. Macaulay liked knockout gas, I guess.
Yeah, it was probably... I mean, as we always see, when there's some new technological innovation, everyone... Because Doc Savage had some similar stuff, too, as well. So it was probably, like, exciting people's imagination that somebody had discovered gas that could do knockouts or something, like... And X-rays and, you know, whatever was cool and in the news at the time was popular, right? But it is a very good story, a narrative device.
yeah.
Knockout gas. So,
like I said, he usually, in the earlier stories, uses a syringe that he plunges into people. So there's a little prick, and then they fall asleep. He hasn't killed anybody in any of the stories, though he does threaten with a gun. Uses an automatic. Sometimes it's a gas gun disguised as an automatic, but sometimes he carries a real gun and will fire over someone's head or what have you.
Right. But he doesn't kill people, right? Like, that seems to be a thing,
no,
right?
No, yeah. But he threatens people.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Like, people thinks he kills people, but he doesn't.
Right. Again, very Batman-esque. I noticed you did a Batman voice when you were doing the Crimson Clown at
the
beginning.
He's described as having a low monotone voice.
Okay, yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Which, again, does not fit with the clown thing, but what are you going to do?
Yeah, yeah.
Should sound like Bozo. I don't know.
I am darkness. I am the night.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The covers for this character from the time actually have him as like just a traditional clown, like a Pagliacci type, but in red.
Mm,
and like
yeah,
with
okay.
full like white face makeup and stuff. But that's,
right.
That's not what he looks like in the stories.
Yeah. Well, I almost feel like you say he wears a hood.
It's a red hood, yeah, and with a white face mask
yeah.
covering.
I almost wonder if like by hood, do they mean like the kind of that kind of jester's cap thing that they'd wear?
No,
like,
no, it's just like a
okay.
onesie.
All right.
It's very simple.
I'm trying to work with you here, McCully. You got to work with me. Okay.
His hands are covered as well, but apparently they're a different color than the rest of his costumes, so they look like he's bare-fingered. He uses false fingerprints.
Ah, nice. Yeah. You could also just wear gloves. Does that mean he frames people by using their fingerprints to steal
no,
stuff?
No. He has a consistent false fingerprint that he uses, so again, it throws them off his actual self's trail.
Okay.
So they think that they have the Crimson Clown's fingerprints, and they just haven't connected it to a criminal yet, but
yeah,
they're just not real fingerprints.
Right.
So Dalton Prowse is a wealthy man about town. It's a little unclear whether it's his actual identity or not. I think it is from some of the implications, but one story has him run into an old criminal buddy who knew him under a different name and who had apparently sent Prowse up the river for a bit. So apparently Prowse did jail time.
Oh, okay. All right.
Like I said, little inconsistent. Actually, something I noticed, because I read Volume 2 before I read Volume 1, and going back in Volume 1, there's references to British stuff. Like, Detective Donler is Detective Inspector Donler, and they use pounds instead of dollars, and lift instead of elevator, and just so on. And by the third story, it actually says it's in London.
I see.
And I went back, and by Volume 2, he's in New York.
Huh.
Like, explicitly. Like, this is before the... Like, I thought it might be, like, he shifted him to New York for the crossover with Thubway Tham, because Tham is explicitly set in New York.
Right.
But no, Volume 2 came out before the crossover, so I don't know.
Hmm. Weird.
And it's not like he moved. Like, all the locations and side characters moved.
Right. Well, that did I mean, it's important to remember when, you know, in these days pre anything we would call real serialization. I mean, well, serialization existed, but in this times of things, it could be like I'd write a story, I'd write three different stories, and then the third one's the one that hit, so I'd start to like ignore the stuff from before. I know that, like, for instance, Robert E. Howard wrote a Conan the Barbarian story, but it was not really Conan the Barbarian. It was just a character named Conan the Barbarian. It was a different character. Like, it's that kind of, and it's like people have tried to fight on over whether or not that was actually meant to be the same character. And you can really change things quite, and to use a more modern example, thinking about how Happy Days was set in the 50s and they just sort of stopped bothering to set it in the 50s by the later seasons. You know, it's that kind of thing, right? So if he was, and I assume McCully was an American, not a British
guy. He was, and I thought that might be like, you know, he's writing what he knows and stuff, but no, he's an American, born in Illinois, lived in America all his life. I don't know.
Yeah. So he just probably decided, let's just quietly make him a New Yorker because that's more popular or something. I don't know. Like that kind of thing happened.
Yeah.
People weren't gonna dig up the old pulp novel magazine from like 3 months ago to check in those days. People weren't quite as nerdy about that stuff. They had to burn it for firewood during the Depression or whatever. They didn't keep them. That's why stuff like that was worth a lot of money if you saved it, you know, because everyone threw it out.
Yeah, fair. It was weird though. noticing that.
Yeah.
Because I had read, like, the Tham crossover, obviously, but even before that, I could have sworn it referenced New York, and it did. It just, early on, he's in London. I don't know.
Yeah, okay. It might have been like, oh, that'll make him exotic. I mean, he didn't live in California either, but he wrote Zorro in, like, the 19th century. So maybe it was kind of like he thought it would be more exotic if he was a British swashbuckler, and then he just changed his mind. I mean, we were mentioning how these European anti-hero type characters were very popular around the same time, so maybe he was trying to tap into that market? I don't know.
But a fun gimmick that the Crimson Clown does is that, how do I put this? He destroys his costumes after use. His costumes are one-time use, and they're chemically treated so that when he applies acid to them, they just burn up in a few seconds, and then he spreads the ashes around.
Okay.
So he can just discard his costumes and not be found with the costumes on him after a job.
Okay.
And this helps because his Zenigata, Dave Donler, who's described as actually a good detective and stuff, but does some pretty stupid things, including trusting Delton Prouse, who he keeps, like, taking on as, like, a helper in the Crimson Clown cases.
That's like Commissioner Gordon with Batman, except Batman actually is trying to help him, you know?
And, like, occasionally Donler's suspicious of Prouse, but Prouse finds a way to throw stuff off his trail, say with the fingerprints or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's a lot of the stories are about getting into the details of how the clown does these heists and stuff. He'll say how he disposes of the costume afterwards, how he hides the loot so he can collect it later, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of clever, daring stuff that probably wouldn't actually work.
Well, like, give me an example of what's a clever heist that he pulls off?
I don't know. Using the dumbwaiter to travel between his own apartment and his target.
Okay. So it's someone in the same building as him, in other words.
Yeah, that was one of the... Yeah, once because he's a rich guy, so he deals with other rich people. So
right.
He uses that as his part of his way of finding targets, and it describes him as stealing from crooks and honest people alike. But it's mostly rich people who are engaging in criminal activities, and he usually jewel smuggling or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
One story early on has him robbing from a grocery store magnat who's jacking up prices.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's what I mean. It would have to be a victim. That, like, a quote victim that you would not want. I doubt he ever goes after someone who is completely innocent, right, in the stories? Like, you never see him.
There's a few ones where he'll just steal a necklace from, like, a wealthy dowager who's there at the, you know, thing. But that's usually not his main target in the story.
Mm.
And again, he gives half to charity, and he actually does do that. Like, that's not just a...
Okay. Well, then, so he's saying, oh, they're rich, so it's fine, they can spare it, basically, right?
Yeah, basically, he's collecting donations for charity.
Uh-huh, yeah.
That's his justification. Like, that's what he says to them. He sort of has a sarcastic tone as the clown. Like, he'll sort of subtly insult his victims and stuff. Like, not full-on jokes like Spider-Man stuff, but, like, he makes snide remarks to them while he's robbing them.
So would you say he's kind of like, he doesn't have a high respect for rich people, even though he is one?
Probably, yeah.
I mean, he got rich, was he, you said he was in jail, although again, we're establishing he's not necessarily very consistent about things, but was he like, he got rich by pulling off heists, or was he born rich and his background is that he's
a
rich
guy? I
got
the impression from most of the stories that he's like from wealth.
Okay, all right.
But... other ones contradict it, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of he kind of moved the goalposts around on things like that.
He does use fake names for like doing criminal stuff, so like dealing with fences and stuff. So it's possible he was like arrested under another name or something.
Right. Yeah, I could almost buy that. Like he started a new identity or whatever, either as a rich guy or as a non-rich guy. Like he if you remember, the Shadow had a couple of different identities and in fact was different. Like he was seen as being a different secret identity from like the pulps to the radio, I believe.
Yeah.
But also it was just that he had all these different identities going just to keep everyone on their toes, more or less.
Oh yeah, that's Phantom Ma has that as well.
Mm-hmm.
He like keeps a number of identities going that people think are actual like people.
Right.
And he often just keeps them going just so he could slip into them at some point when it's convenient and use that to commit a crime or what have you.
Right, right. Exactly. There's if you've got enough money that you can make that your full-time thing, then there's like whenever you hear that, it's like they have to be rich to pull that off, because you can't just do that in your spare time. You can't like live three different lives plus be a criminal mastermind or a superhero or whatever on the spare time. That would be keep you too busy, basically.
On the grocery store thing, that's interesting. I'm not sure what Macaulay's politics are. I didn't research the man his personality and stuff. But there's some interesting political stuff in some of these stories. Like, Thuboy Tham has, a recurring character in most of the stories. His landlord, Nosey Moore, who owns the building he lives in. And in the first story, it says, Nosey Moore used to be a career criminal, but he got sent up the river. And then he's got out, and he doesn't want to be on the wrong side of the law anymore because he doesn't want to go back to jail. And he figures being a landlord is kind of like being a criminal. Like, that's an actual joke from the book. Like,
good for him. I don't want to make broad sweeping statements about this stuff, but it really does feel like that kind of thing was like more bubbling to the public consciousness in the first 20, 30 years of the 20th century. Like,
yeah,
there really were much more, and I mean, it was the era of the Depression, of course, but
is before the Depression, but yeah,
right, but well, even before the Depression, there was like, it was kind of the Gilded Age and the mm-hmm. like the 20s, the Roaring 20s. I mean, that was the era when, you know, people were bootlegging because of Prohibition, and there was a staggering wealth, you know, and desperate poverty, and like there was just a lot more sort of cultural class awareness, I think, in general. And you could just say stuff like that, and it would be, you know, if it would, like, you would pander to the masses. I mean, not that you don't now to a certain extent, but like it was much easier to say, yeah, those rich people are scum, these are good, honest, you know, working people. And there was a bit more like visible class antagonism, I think, at that time, even if you weren't like actively a socialist or whatever. Because I mean, yeah, it is important to remember, like, socialism was just regular people and like rural people and poor people. It wasn't you know, we associate it with like people smoking pipes in academic universities and stuff, but like that was when it was coming up from the streets, and it shifted into being like an intellectual exercise for a lot of people after World War II. But it was like there were a lot, this was the heyday of unions in a lot of ways, not to get into all that stuff again, but like, yeah, it's I think that painting like that sort of class awareness was kind of taken for granted in a lot of 20s and 30s and prior stuff in a way that you don't see as much now, especially in America. It might not have been as true in Europe either, but I, you know, anyway, so I'm kind of speculating on what I've seen, and I'm sure someone like Jess Nevins could tell me if I'm being wrong about this, but I got that general impression, you know, compared to, say, you know, the, you know, 19th century, it was, you know, the literature was coming a bit more from the wealthy and at least middle class, whereas this was the explosion of sort of pulp literature, I think, around that time. Because it's possible, yeah, it's possible literacy rates were going up at that point too, and like poorer people were more likely to be able to read.
And also these were, as you said, pulps. Like, they were
cheap
books that you could just pick. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And these were
magazines in this case, but yeah.
Right, and these were meant to be sort of for the lowbrow, supposedly, the regular folks, instead of, you know, the hoity-toity novels, which is ironic because novels were also, you go back 100 years and novels were seen as a déclassé, trashy medium as well, because it was for bored housewives, basically. Yeah, which is always, it's just interesting how that shift kind of happened.
I'm having trouble coming to mind some of the more interesting, like, getaway stuff. There are some, but I'm just having trouble articulating how it works. Say, in the Thuboy Tham crossover, he's like cornered in the hotel room of the guy he's going after, and he sort of escapes, but the cops have a dragnet on the building and stuff, so he decides to just go back to the room that they found him breaking into.
Okay.
Because, like, you know, why would he do that?
Right, right. Well, you know, you say that, but that actually is a thing. Criminals tend to return to the scene of the crime a lot of the time. And that's often how they're arrested.
While there's cops there.
No, even while there's cops there. That has happened. I mean, in realistic. But yeah, it doesn't seem to make any sense. But I guess I'm thinking more of like murderers and like serial killers and things. But I mean,
like,
this
he's
is
caught breaking in, so he He goes back to that room after he escapes.
Yeah, that's
and just hangs out there.
Yeah, that's funny. No, you're right. I mean, it makes sense as a way to evade attention. But yeah,
actually, they used a similar thing in the movie How to Steal a Million, which is a Audrey Hepburn movie from the late '60s, where they are breaking into a museum and they do a thing where they alert all the guards, so the guards are rushing around and they hide out in the guard room, like the guards' lounge. Because that's the only place the guards won't be.
Nice. Right. It's the diagram with the plane with the flat places that were shot. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's talk about the crossover, yeah.
Yeah, there's actually an earlier crossover, which I came across in the Thubway Tham collection I read. And actually between another author's character, Amos Clackworthy, who I hadn't heard of, but he's a con man character.
Okay.
Created by Christopher B. Booth, seemed to first appear in early 20s. It's a little hard to find dates on some of these, especially since... You know, they're listed, like, some of the Crimson Clown books are listed as being published in 2018. No, that's just when the reprint came out. That's not...
Okay.
And it's a little annoying, because I know this was not written in 2018, so...
Yeah, yeah, right.
You're not being very helpful here.
Yeah. That seems... There definitely seems to have been a boom just lately of a lot of old pulp stuff getting... Like, I know Black Mask Publishing does that kind of thing, and, like, that... It just seems like there's been a lot more availability of that stuff just in the last 10... 15 years?
Yeah. Especially, I mean, the early Crimson Clown stories are public domain, so that's probably part of it.
Yeah.
Though you'd think they'd be online. Like, Crimson Clown is hard to find outside of these few collections that I found. Again, odd. I know there's rights issues around Zorro, even though the character by rights should be in public domain. There's a company that claims ownership and will sue anybody who tries to use Zorro in anything. They have deep pockets, so, like, it's a nuisance lawsuit, but, like, it's... prohibitively, but I don't know if these other characters are facing similar things, because nobody really cares about Crimson Clown or Thubway Tham.
Yeah, 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 right, yeah.
But yeah, so there was a crossover, and I'm not sure which writer wrote it, but interesting, it might be the earliest crossover between two different authors' characters. Not sure.
Interesting. Yeah, we'd have to look into that. I feel like that's probably not true. I mean, if we're not... Yeah, I don't know. We've already talked about people who, like, wrote unauthorized sequels to Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and stuff, so I mean...
I feel like outside, like, approved crossover.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Not stuff like Arsène Lupin versus Herlock Sholmes or what have you.
I met Sherlock Holmes, and he is my friend, and we went on a date together, you know, fanfic of the 19th century. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that did happen.
I know! I mean, that's like, what I'm approved, saying! Like, yeah.
Approved crossovers. I mean, I don't know, but yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is a con man character who, again, just is a short story, but he crosses paths with Tham. Clackworthy's from Chicago, and Tham, of course, is from New York, and Clackworthy's comes to New York, and he has an altercation with Tham, and Tham steals his wallet from his jacket pocket, but Clackworthy said, no, that was just a decoy wallet. I keep my real wallet in my vest pocket, and the decoys to attract, dips and stuff. And Tham said, you should check your vest pocket. And so he does, and his wallet's missing. And Clackworthy just lets Tham go and says, all right, you earned that.
Yes.
So that's sort of the first crossover with these characters, or with Tham and another character. But we'll get to the Crimson Clown and Thubway Tham, which is from 1928. There's actually not a lot to probably say story-wise about this, because it's just sort of both characters doing their own thing, but they're working on a mutual job, and the clown hires Sam to pick the pocket of this criminal, like the leader of the Baron Blood gang. Blood spelled B-L-E-U-D.
Okay.
So it's his actual name.
Okay.
And so, and there's plans in the wallet that the clown needs, so he hires Tham to steal the wallet, and Tham doesn't like working outside of the subway, but he decides, you know, it's $1,000, he'll do it. Craddock actually almost catches him, but the clown lifts the wallet from Tham before Craddock finds him.
Okay.
So he doesn't catch him with the goods on him.
Mm.
And then they have sort of, like, the Baron Blood gang start coming after Tham, and so the Crimson Clown sets up things to protect Tham, like, actually alerts the cops that the Crimson Clown has been staying in Tham's building, with the idea that this will put a right. police guard on the building so that right. the criminals won't be able to go in and assassinate them.
What is it, sorry, just before you keep going, what is it that makes Baron, like, that attracts Baron Blood's, like, the Crimson Clown's attention to Baron Blood? What does he
in
do?
In this case, it's actually, and it's not very well explained, but the clown gets blackmailed at the beginning by somebody who's never revealed. Baron Blood recently made a big heist involving, among other things, the Moon Ruby, Baron Blood's keeping in his own private collection. That's the main thing that the clown is sent after, to basically return to the collection that it came from.
Okay.
And then at the end, once the clown is successful, he gets another letter from this blackmailer who says that he's dying and he won't be able to collect on it, but, you know, thanks.
Hmm.
And so it ends with, you know, the clown realizing they'll never know who this guy was.
Yeah. Does Baron Blood have, like, a... Does he wear a costume or do anything flamboyant?
No, he's just a guy.
He's just a guy, yeah. Okay.
Some of these characters, some of these... the villains in these... in the Crimson Clown stories aren't, like, interesting.
Okay.
I think that's like, a thing. Apparently, the Shadow's villains aren't that unique either.
Mm.
Like, we noticed that was a lot of the Doc Savage villains were just sort of bland.
Yeah. Well,
there,
I
there
mean,
were
with
some,
the Shadow,
like, striking ones, but,
with the Shadow, he just flat out, I think he murders a lot of them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So they can't really be that interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Doc Savage had some interesting villains, like, much later, but yeah, like.
Yeah, like Mr. Sunshine, was that one of the, yeah.
Yeah.
But they're not as interesting as the heroes. I feel like unique villains came out of the superhero era. Like, I feel that like that's something unique to superheroes, like a recurring rogues gallery of, like, villains who could carry their own stories, that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I could be talking out of my butt here, but like,
well, I mean, as we say, this is almost like it's about the villains in many ways. Oh,
yeah.
another example of the hero, the villain, is Fu Manchu, who was, like, he technically was the villain to a protagonist, Nayland Smith, but Fu Manchu himself got so interesting and everyone preferred Fu Manchu, so nobody remembers Nayland Smith, everyone remembers Fu Manchu as the villain.
Yeah, same with Phantom Ma, like, those stories are supposedly about Detective Zhuv, but, you know, to the point where, like, when they did Phantom Ma movies in the 60s, Zhuv was just, like, a bumbling character.
Right. Ella, the Pink Panther, right.
I believe Kim Newman has said that he believes that the Pink Panther is, like, derivative of the 60s Phantom Ma movies.
Yeah, I was wondering about... Yeah, okay, yeah. Anyway, that's interesting.
This is a little off topic, but,
yeah.
Like, he's got a...
Well, it's all part of the same strand, which is interesting. Anyway, go on, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, Baron Blood, name aside, is just a typical gangster character. He's got, you know, the Baron Blood mob, and the clown systematically goes through his henchmen, and they all keep the jewels like within their clothing, like in the lining and stuff. So the clown keeps kidnapping them and then cutting their clothes up and then sending them out naked with, like, half the loot still on them, so they get arrested. Again, the clown's kind of a jerk to some of these villains, but, you know.
Well, it's the classic thing of their, yeah, like, you pick the people you pick people bad enough and the hero can be a jerk because they deserve it, right? So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I mentioned he gives half to charity. He often only takes half of the loot in the first place.
Okay.
He often leaves half of it for the, you know, criminal to hold on to.
Okay.
Unless they give him a lot of trouble, in which case he'll take it out of spite.
Okay.
And he'll say as much.
All right.
So I guess he gives a quarter of the loot to charity because he only keeps a quarter himself.
Well, if it's a big enough score, you know, that's how
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how does it resolve itself, this story, with the
yeah?
Blood?
So Tham finds out that because the Crimson Clown is going to Baron Blood's apartment, he knows he's going to threaten Baron Blood into giving up the ruby. Tham finds out that the Craddock and Donler, who have teamed up. Not much to say about that, but it's nice seeing two, like, Zenigata types team up against their
yeah
their common rivals, and also, like, they're both NYPD by this point, so they just know each other. Like, they don't have a meeting.
Mm.
Like, they know each other before the story starts, which I thought was interesting.
ACAP. All cops are pals.
I mean, I guess they're both detectives at NYPD, like high-ranking detectives.
Yeah, yeah.
They probably already know each other.
Yeah, fair.
Anyway, so Tham phones with the idea to give the Crimson Clown a warning, a heads-up that the cops are coming, but Baron Blood intercepts it and is trying to screw over the clown. but the clown manages to get out of the tight spot. I mentioned he hides out in the apartment that he was robbing, and then sort of waits for and manages to escape. Yeah, and then it, you know, ends with him giving, you know, the remaining money to Tham, and Tham having a last conversation with Craddock. Yeah, like I said, the story itself is pretty basic, but I thought it was an interesting, like the characters are interesting enough that there's enough here to talk about.
Yeah. When was the actual novel published, by the way?
28.
28. Okay, so that's interesting. I was just thinking, again, I mentioned Robert E. Howard. He had two of his characters, Cull and Bran MacMore, and this is pre-Conan.
Right, I read that one. Yeah.
They crossed over, and it would have been around the same time. It might have been, I should...
But yeah, that was in the Cull collection that we talked about way back.
I just want to see what year that crossover came out, if it was the same year. So it's just interesting. 29. Okay, so yeah, Cull didn't appear until 29, so this would have been before the crossover that I mentioned. So this was... But definitely you can see how the comic book idea of crossovers was starting to become popular around this time.
Yeah,
so that's interesting.
We talked about the C.L. Moore crossing over two of her characters, Jor-El of Shuari and Northwest Smith.
Right, yeah.
And that was probably around this time.
No,
that would have been 30s.
She was a little later, but but it definitely became a thing of like, oh, if you've got two popular characters, throw them together. And it's funny that like, you know, comic books are very unrestrained in doing this, but like, these are... The Cull and Bran MacMore story needs time travel to work, you know? And so does the C.L. Moore story. Like, at least with the Crimson Clown's Thubway Tham, they could very easily occupy the same world. It's not as big a deal, I guess. But they're not afraid to really mix it up to get the two characters together, which is kind of funny.
And there's a repeated thing where Tham keeps just telling Craddock, yeah, I'm working for the Crimson Clown. And Craddock thinks he's being sarcastic, but he just, you know... He's being honest in
right.
a sarcastic voice.
Yeah, right.
Because they do see, like, it is like, I don't know, Batman teaming up with, and like
Sherlock
this has
Holmes,
happened.
But, which happened, yeah.
No, not Sherlock Holmes, but like, I don't know, are there any pickpocket characters these days? I don't know,
small-timey
character.
Like
Batman's teamed up with almost everybody, so it's whatever I can think of probably has happened.
Yeah. But someone not in the DC universe, though. Like yeah, exactly.
Like a mundane sort of character.
Walter White. I don't know. No.
Batman versus Walter White.
Yeah, there you go. I always said if they did a Leave It to Extraordinary Gentlemen modern version, Walter White should be the villain. But anyway.
There's a character who appears in a few Tham stories that I wish had stuck around. A love interest named Nettie Bird, who's the daughter of a criminal. She actually gets him out of a jam when she's introduced because Tham is about to be caught with the goods on him by Craddock. And then he finds to his surprise that he doesn't have the wallet he just stole. And then it turns out that this woman who had known him when he was younger stole it from him. to save him from being caught by Craddock. And then they have a relationship for a few stories. They get engaged. He's really happy about it. But then between stories, she just leaves to be an actress. It feels a little like a letdown.
Mm.
Like, we could have at least gotten that scene. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's, again, they weren't writing for, like, what will happen in the next story at that time.
Exactly.
Just, you know, how,
like,
how
some writers were, but these ones weren't.
Yeah.
And Thubway Tham had more recurring characters because it's like a comedy thing. Not a lot for Crimson Clown, just sort of Dave Donler is introduced a few stories in, who becomes a fixture. And Dalton Prowse's home, Manborough Arms, originally Manborough Home. I guess it's a difference between... British and American naming of apartment complexes, but yeah, it's like a wealthy neighborhood, you know, like the Arconia or whatever. I've been watching
only Murders in the building. Yeah,
right. Yeah, that's the only wealthy New York apartment I can name because it's on that show, but yes.
Yeah,
but yeah, I'd recommend checking out some of these stories if you can get them. Like the actual crossover is probably not that interesting, like on its own, but the characters are, and I think it's a good window into seeing how these characters, like what their deal is.
Yeah.
The Crimson Clown in particular, as we mentioned, did lead into a lot of superhero stuff, like maybe not directly, but like various influences. Like it's part of the stepping stone to stuff like Batman and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's so much of a stew in the early 20s. I do really find it interesting that like all the ingredients of superheroes were just kicking around for decades before they really culminated in, you know, Superman. I mean, a lot of people would argue Superman isn't really the first superhero anyway.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, like you've got all those kinds of characters as we've discussed ad nauseum on this show, but it is
and
just...
of course, Zorro being a major influence on Batman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is just, it's just really interesting to me that like that, and even when you had superhero comics first making their appearance, like the rules were not there as much. So there were a lot of very strange characters who came out of comics as well. So it's just, it's funny how like the what we think of as the rules for superheroes or even whether it was a superhero or not were so elastic. It's just, it is interesting. And this is definitely a window on that.
Well, folks, the cops are clothing in and it's time to discard our clown costumes and run. I've been enterprising Dip Philip Rice, and my co-host was Adam Prother, a fixture of high society who secretly dons a costume. Not for crimes, though. Sir was Alex Roth, who vows to one day catch us with the goods and send us up the river. And our theme music was provided by Subway busker Jack Furyk. Just a reminder that we both have a Patreon, which helps pay for hosting costs and whatnot, and if you subscribe to either of us, you can steal this is really hard, folks. You can steal this podcast early every time, as well as getting bonus material, cut footage, and illustrations and comics, amongst other things. Just go to Patreon and search for Philip Rice, 1L, or Adam Prother, 2 S's. Or whatmad-universe.pinecast.co for the length. Almost done. You can also follow us on Blue Sky at whatmaduniverse, or prankster36 for Adam, or spearhavoc for me. I did it.
Yay. You could have dropped it. I would not have complained. But you did it. So I give you congratulations.
See you all next crime. There we go.